thank God for the stupid royal wedding. Because for at least a few hours there, Twitter was not 100% about Jordan Peterson's lobsters or the insanity of the Trump-Russia investigation. Hello, everybody, and welcome to the Reason Podcast. I am Matt Welch, doing the editor's roundtable on this Monday with my unindicted co-conspirators, Catherine Mangu Ward, Peter Suderman, Nick Gillespie. Which one of you was watching the royal wedding this weekend?
Wasn't it in the middle of the night?
I think it was early in the morning.
It was all day coverage, though. Yeah, I watched it. I watched part
okay.
of it.
Was it good?
No.
Let's go jump into the news. As much as we might want to not talk about Trump-Russia, because it gets boring in our own brains after a while, that is dominating the headlines this morning. So let's get the sort of state of current play here to talk about it. On Sunday, President of the United States tweeted, "I hereby demand that the Department of Justice look into whether or not the FBI, DOJ infiltrated or surveilled the Trump campaign for political purposes." This led the Benjamin Wittes's of the world, if that is indeed how you pronounce his last name, to warn that Trump is, quote, precariously close to creating a genuine crisis in America. Said crisis was diffused a couple hours later by the perennially embattled Deputy Attorney General Rod Rosenstein when he announced in a statement that if anyone did infiltrate or surveil participants in a presidential campaign for inappropriate purposes, we need to know about it and take appropriate action. And there you go. Meanwhile, Rudy Giuliani is saying that Robert Mueller is telling him that the whole thing's going to get wrapped up by September 1st. And everybody is looking for the magic bullet or the magic ShamWow to make the entire thing go away. So, Peter Suderman, let's start with you. When are we finally going to get that constitutional crisis that you've been promising us?
I haven't been promising it, but, you know, everybody has been saying that we're constantly somewhere between 6 hours and 6 weeks, you know, a kind of a short Friedman unit away from a constitutional crisis. I'm not entirely sure that's wrong, but it's also sort of strikes me as not inevitable. And hey, look, if we're looking for an endpoint here, you know, Rudy Giuliani is saying that Mueller told him that this whole investigation might be wrapped up by September 1st, provided that Trump agrees to an interview, which he may not. If Mueller decides to subpoena him, Giuliani said, well, there's definitely going to be litigation about this. I would just sort of say, you know, the weird thing about this is that this isn't the first time that Trump has called for a kind of second layer investigation. He tweeted basically, "I'm going to call for something," about a year ago, or a little less than a year ago. And in addition, the Justice Department has already launched an investigation into how the FBI got permission to spy on Carter Page. That was launched in March. So, in fact, there already is an investigation into the investigation. I do, of course, hope that this will end with an investigation into that investigation, kind of Monty Python credit style.
A Matryoshka investigation.
Right, where we, you know, the people who have been hired to write these credits have been sacked. The people who have been hired to write the credits who have been sacked have also been sacked. And we can just sort of keep going and, you know, the dominoes can keep falling. And
At what point does Lois Lerner become president of the United States? I think that's the only possible stopping point.
That already
point.
Happened. You missed it.
Yeah.
It's straightforward from here, Nick. Catherine, there seems to be, maybe I'm being a little bit weirdly optimistic about this, but we seem to be congealing on a couple of theories of the case. We kind of have known what the anti-Trump theory of the case is up till now, even though a lot of it is still guesswork because Robert Mueller's investigation hasn't actually been leaking all that much. But on the right, the theory of the case appears to be that there was a politicized kind of what's the word for it? What's the amnesia again? Striking me on a Monday morning, but let's look for anything possible. Let's throw counterintelligence operatives at the sleazeballs around the Trump campaign, and surely they will find up something. And that these people were politicized. They're connected with people who are connected with Hillary Clinton. So my question to you: Catherine. Should we be? Should we take those concerns seriously that there was some kind of top-down counterintelligence op spearheaded by the Obama administration to dig up dirt on people who were a little bit dirty as a way to kind of thwart the ambitions of the renegade Donald Trump?
So first, I would say I have absolutely no freaking idea. Second, though, I would say probably everything you said is true except the top-down part. It makes total sense to me that people with investigatory powers who think that it's bad that Trump becomes president and who also think that he's probably doing bad things would look into it. And I think the answer is very, very likely to be the same thing it always is, which is everybody did things that were sort of reasonable, but a little bit against the law. And in the end, one or two of those people will hang for the sort of reasonable, but a little bit against the law things they did. Probably mostly just the perjury bits in the end, because that's where we always end up.
OK, come on. Let me ask, maybe ask you specifically, Catherine, but everybody on this. Do we think that Michael Cohen just occasionally did some stuff that was very lightly against, you know, sort of like the kind of like, you know, the financial equivalent of driving 12 miles an hour over the speed limit?
I don't think it's 12 miles an hour over, but I do think that, you know, the sort of thing that Cohen is accused of doing is, you know, they thought, OK, this is shady. We know it's not quite right. On the other hand, it's standard practice in the entertainment industry, and oops, now we're in politics and everything's a little different, but
and we also think that that's true about Paul Manafort, the guy who's not just like working in the entertainment industry, but is running PR ops foreign dictators.
I fully concede I fully concede all of it's
sure.
dirty, but I also think it's people who thought they were going to skate by a little bit on the wrong side of the law, but not actually probably get caught because everyone had bigger fish to fry. And then these little fish grew into big fish. Sorry, Matt Welsh, to do that to you.
I know. I totally understand what you're saying.
And they congealed on the theory of the case.
Can
as
fish
you
congeal?
Can we stop saying congeal?
No, we'll never stop
like
saying
I'm
congeal.
I feel like I'm at a, like 4 o'clock at a lunch buffet at a crappy Chinese restaurant.
You always, that is where, that's where you spiritually live, Nick, so don't lie.
Oh, yeah,
you
yeah,
always
yeah,
are
yeah,
at 4 o'clock
is my
at a
spirit
Chinese
animal
restaurant
is a,
buffet.
Yeah. That's no, what Ohio is.
Again,
is actually
I don't want to excuse
that.
The
it
behavior.
Is part of the buffet belt.
I don't want to excuse the behavior of all these people. I think the stuff that Cohen is accused of is terrible. I think the stuff that Manafort is accused of is terrible. But I don't think it rises to the level of I think at this level, at least Trump is right. I don't think it rises to the level of let's devote the entire investigatory apparatus of the very top levels of the federal government to figuring out what happened here. The answer is they're all a bunch of bags of dicks and they did a bunch of terrible things and they're not actually threats to national security in the end.
Well, you know, I agree with Catherine that, you know, a lot there's a lot of stuff that is probably flat out illegal or certainly kind of work in the knife's edge between legal and illegal. The real question, though, you know, with people around Trump, I think it's also true, Matt, you mentioned that the Podesta group, you know, basically did anything that Paul Manafort was accused of in terms of, you know, representing shady characters. You know, in the former Soviet Union and whatnot. There was a very good Josh Barrow column at Business Insider who said, you know, like when you're looking at all of these conflicts of interest, you'd need to acknowledge that it was actually the Clintons who really did kind of normalize a lot of this behavior. And all during the time when Hillary Clinton was both a senator from New York as well as especially as Secretary of State, her supporters were like, come on, it's no big deal that her husband is giving speeches for $500,000 to groups that, you know, that are asking for favors or preferential treatment or just, you know, contact with the American government, with the U.S. government. There's a lot of this stuff going on here. I think the larger question is, like, does any of this rise to a constitutional crisis? And I think the answer has to be no. You know, who cares? Michael Cohen's a piece of shit. Paul Manafort's a piece of shit. None of the stuff that they're, you know, that is being looked at least publicly so far, has anything to do with Donald Trump per se or the Trump campaign or administration.
Wait a minute.
Dealing with
what
Russia.
About,
no.
Just one second. What about Donald Trump's son seeking dirt from what he believed to be a Russian source who was going to provide dirt on Hillary
Clinton.
Yeah,
let's see what happened.
Right? Like, you know, the campaign
that's not,
specifically.
Yeah, and that is not a constitutional crisis. Okay, and let me put it this way. If it turns out that Don Jr. or Eric or, you know, whatever other Trump they're hiding behind the curtains
Harpo.
Did
Tiffany.
Stuff like that,
That's the real twist.
They should be held accountable. There is, you know, that's not a constitutional crisis. Nothing that Trump has done so far is, you know, is crisis, I don't think. And we're talking about this because we're talking about impeachment since the Republicans impeached Clinton for things that they really shouldn't have. And you'll recall there was that brief boomlet about 6 months ago of stories about how, it was right from Democrats or liberals. And I remember a bunch of people at Vox writing this story as well as elsewhere. Yeah, you know, it was really legitimate to impeach Bill Clinton, and we should have done more. He actually should have stepped down. All of that you can see is just like it's trying to soften the ground for the idea that Trump should both be impeached and removed for office for any sort of, misdemeanor. And it just, so far it isn't coming up. And I think this discussion is nuts. And it's part of Trump. I absolutely think it's part of Trump derangement syndrome. And more important, like, we're not going to get to better government or better governance or a good 2020 election if we're constantly talking about Trump and Paul Manafort, during the campaign, because that's not where we're at. And that's not going to help us get to a place where we actually have legitimate presidential contenders that at least 50% of the population might vote for.
That's never going to happen again in our lifetimes. I think, Nick, to the just on the narrow point, the claim about constitutional crisis is usually not what happened, but how people might respond to a moment that might happen in the future. And part of it, I think, is the everybody wants to have the apocalypse. They don't want to acknowledge the slow decline. And it's the same kind of thing when it comes to, you know, the ongoing scandal. We're always imagining what the thing's going to blow up when it looks like it, when in fact it probably or might not blow up. It'll just sort of be this kind of sad, dragging bit. Let's switch topics since we need to go from topic to topic quickly. On Friday, we had yet another deadly school shooting. This time at Santa Fe High School in or near Houston, where 10 people were murdered. Nick, you wrote a post that was titled, "What Can Be Done to Stop School Shootings Without Shredding the Constitution?" So I guess my question to you is, what can be done to stop school shootings without shredding the Constitution?
That's a good question, man. You know, in fact, it's Thank a you. Great question.
Thank you.
But the short answer is it doesn't seem like very much. And I say that as somebody, the point of my piece was actually more about the ways in which gun control or gun rights supporters have been winning legal battle after legal battle for 20 plus years, first at the state level and then more recently about 10 years ago at the Supreme Court level, where the Supreme Court and the ruling interpretation of the Second Amendment is that it does protect an individual right to own and bear arms, which, you know, was a long time coming. But they are also losing the culture war, or it seems likely that they are, because school shootings and other mass shootings are happening, not necessarily with more frequency. We have run pieces where mass shootings are not more common, but they are more violent, and increasing numbers of people across every possible demographic are saying that we need tighter gun control laws. We need to do something about mass shootings. And part of what I'm talking about in that piece is how do libertarians, who tend to be very strong Second Amendment people, engage in that argument? Because in the end, culture is, culture comes first, politics comes second. And for regardless of what's going on, if you believe in a robust Second Amendment, I think you've got to come up with better arguments you still have virtually no chance of having your kid killed in a school shooting. Waffle House is still fundamentally safe to eat at other than the food itself. Things like that. Like, we need to start engaging in what are the fears, what are the anxieties of people, and then how do we address that? Because the fact is that as gun laws have become more liberalized and people can own and carry more guns in more circumstances, violent crime has gone down, and gun-related violence has gone down. You know, we need to start having a conversation other than shut up, you stupid fucking gun grabber, you know, from my cold dead hands. That's not going to win the future in this debate.
Suderman, picking up on that, we like to have sport, and I presume that we will soon have a sport with various NRA spokes creatures who, after moments like this, have a tendency to blame video games or blame the culture or this and that. And there's the Texas politician who's blaming the
Lieutenant Governor of Texas, Dan Patrick, blamed too many. Sorry, was it? I think it was too many doors.
Doors. Yeah. So many doors. If only these schools.
I think
schools
it was a rock music critique.
Had fewer doors.
Kind of, again, picking up where Nick left off, if it isn't about the guns and it isn't about the doors, isn't there, must there be something that's sick in the culture out there? There's some factor out there that is leading to the more deadliness of these particular school shootings, and shouldn't we be out there looking for this and, as the case may be, trying to ameliorate it, whatever that word means?
So when we're talking very specifically about mass school shootings, typically by students or former students, it's a very specific and narrow category. It's not mass shootings overall. It's not gun deaths or gun violence overall. We're talking specifically about that. I'm convinced is not quite the word, but I find the idea that these are basically that this is a sort of slow motion set of copycats post Columbine that we have been sort of living with for about 20 years now, reasonably convincing, and that what these folks are doing is sort of seeking a kind of fame and attention, acting out in a way that has been modeled for them and that has been that the media has blown up and has given that has planted this idea in their heads. And so I do think that there is really something to be said. It's not a total solution. It's not maybe it's certainly not the only thing perhaps that could be done. But in terms of this one specific category of mass shooting, I do think that there really is something to be said for the idea that the media should stop covering the identities of the shooters, the lives of the shooters, photos of the shooters, in particular, the kinds of, you know, like I'm posing with guns looking, you know, really macho, whatever, on Instagram. Stop posting that stuff. Stop making so much out of the shooters and their personas. Because I do think that, let's put it this way, just outside of the world of shooting, outside when whatever parts of the world, you know, sort of you're looking at, most people aren't super innovative. People do things that they have seen done before. And so in this case, what we want is for fewer people to see this and see it as a path to fame and infamy. And I think that, again, I'm not saying that it would totally stop every school shooting. I'm not saying that it's the only thing to think about. But for this one narrow category, I think that there really is something that we really ought to consider a kind of not a gag, certainly not a law, but a kind of a self-enforced muting in major media outlets of how we talk about the shooters themselves, their intentions, and how we portray them in the aftermath of these events.
Peter,
Catherine,
can I
ask? When are you going to fire Peter?
I'm sorry. Can I just ask a quick question? You know that idea that you know this is slow motion copycat stuff. Why haven't mass shootings gone up, if that's the case, including school shootings? It seems to me that's a popular theory, and even people at National Review are talking about it now. And it just seems to me on its face implausible, because if that were the case, we would see more school shootings, and the numbers don't actually bear that out.
I'm not sure I agree with that. In fact, what I think that this is that these kids are the people who do this are obviously disturbed in some way, and they're people who are prone to acting out and making, let's say, bad, obviously much worse than making bad decisions, but making bad decisions. In a world where they didn't have this as an idea in their head, they would do something else antisocial, something perhaps even violent. But hopefully, perhaps, I think it is possible at least, that they would do things that were less violent, that did not result in this sort of in these sorts of effects.
And like it's some good old-fashioned Satanism or something, right? Like if your relevant panic is a bunch of kids drawing pentagrams on the ground instead of shooting up their school.
Right, like rob a convenience store without a weapon, like kids used to do. Like I knew kids that did this in my high school is that like they would go and like for fun, they would rob convenience. They would like go and see what they could pack into their pants, into their bags, whatever. Right? You go create a distraction, that sort of thing. And I'm not saying again that is also not good. It is much preferable, however,
what I'm saying is where are the numbers that bear this out? Because otherwise, it's just these.
But the
ideas
numbers
are
so small that it's not. The numbers themselves don't signify, right? Like I think it's always very, very important to note that these things are not up, and I think Reason does that a lot, and you've done that here, and that's good. But at the same time, what we're talking about is a number of incidents so small that there is no information in the statistical significance. There's only information in the cultural relevance. And so I think that's where the Sudermann critique here is relevant, is to say...
No. I understand that, but we would not stand for that argument if in almost any other case.
But look, the folks who are committing these acts are saying in advance. They are frequently obsessed with other mass shooters. They think of them as models. And so
sometimes, not always, and like Nicholas Cruz, if I can put a counter out there, and again, this from a libertarian
consistent.
Point
and this
of
is
view,
why again I didn't yeah. I said up front, I am not totally convinced by this. However, I think it is certainly an idea that we should be discussing and should be sort of
a counter policy that might work is that we know at least with Nicholas Cruz and with the Waffle House shooter that they had so many touch points with law enforcement, with, kind of psychological services state provided, as well as school discipline in the case of Cruz himself. I think, and then when you also, on top of that, look at at the Parkland shooting in Florida, the absolute failure of police. Like one of the places, if the goal is to reduce the number of fatalities at schools, and if school shootings are not going up wildly in numbers, and there is no real pattern that we can discern because there's so few, one of the things we can look at is like how often are child protective services completely failing on every possible level, psychological testing services, educational services. The shooter in Texas who had been in the military and hence they didn't contribute to the proper database to show that this guy should not have legally been able to own a gun. There are so many laws on the books that are not being followed or policies that I think that that's actually a place to start. And it might be a place, again, where we can find common ground with the people who are particularly exercised, about this for good reasons and are saying the only solution is to ban all guns or to all classes of guns, et cetera. I think one of the things that we need to look at, and this is unsettling from a libertarian perspective, is not what kind of guns are out there, because that doesn't seem to matter. In the most recent school shooting, it was mostly a sawed-off shotgun that was bought at a Walmart. I mean, it was called a starter rifle by one commentator. We got to look at who is getting guns, and that raises a lot of disturbing civil liberties questions, but that may be a place to start a conversation.
Catherine, Nick is trying to not go the simple... hey, you dumb gun grabbers, route, which I think is the is correct on one level, maybe even two. On the other hand, feels like to me just sort of watching people's reaction to this, which at this point plays out pretty scripted along predictable lines. Feels like that among people who blame this stuff on the prevalence of guns and the primacy of both gun culture and Second Amendment rights, that for a large block of that people, they're not really interested in understanding. When you were portraying those who believe that the Second Amendment is an individual right, which it is now enshrined in the Constitution, when you portray those people as not caring about students getting killed at high schools, doesn't seem to me that there's a lot of interest in actually understanding where people are coming from. So what do you do about that?
Yeah, I think the flip side of the point that Nick is making is the need to hold the ground on the Second Amendment. I don't know if y'all have been reading closely the last several posts by Declan McCullough on our site, but he's basically just telling a story about in California in particular, where at the state level, they're just quietly eliminating all kinds of edge cases for Second Amendment rights, including California's cities that are essentially using zoning to make it impossible to open a gun store, including concealed carry, including, just a whole bunch of other policies, including a piece not in California, but something that he wrote about a couple weeks back in Nevada of a student who is not allowed to wear a T-shirt with the number 2 and the letter A on it. And I do think it's good to be thoughtful and to say to do all your to be sures. But I also think that the Second Amendment as an individual right is genuinely imperiled, and that unsophisticated claims about gun culture and the prevalence of the Second Amendment will lead to further incursions. And so maybe the service we can do is to just once again say, this is how rare these are. Don't conflate all gun deaths with homicides. Don't conflate homicides with mass shootings. Don't conflate mass shootings with school shootings, which everyone does all the time, everywhere.
My go-to kind of analogy of where the gun debate is that it's an inversion of where the abortion debate is, or it's kind of similar in that both have been decided. The big question has been decided at the Supreme Court level. And so the actual action on where the edge is being defined is happening on state and local level, where there's a pretty wide divergence of opinion there. And so you have in New York, people are trying to chase off the NRA from even having fundraisers, this type of thing, where you'll see a very different view on gun rights in Texas and elsewhere, which might actually be a transition point to the news also from Friday about the Trump administration qualified defunding of Planned Parenthood, or ruling out Planned Parenthood cannot receive certain types of money from Title X funding if there is also abortion services in the right next to where they are providing family counseling and other types of things. I guess just to start with, Peter, since you're Johnny Healthcare, if you're able to just sort of describe what happened Friday, and if you can't, I'll let Catherine do it because she's late.
And could you please, Peter, answer this in the voice of Johnny Healthcare? Yeah, I got to tell you out there, Matt, it's pretty bad out here. Johnny Healthcare is having some trouble.
So
seems
Johnny
like
Healthcare,
maybe
what
you
is,
should.
Yeah, wow. That's I wanna see that comic book character. Probably not as drawn
didn't
by Peter
somebody
Bagg,
do
get
a
me
healthcare
Johnny
reform
healthcare.
Comic book? Didn't that happen, Peter?
It did.
Yes,
actually,
indeed.
Peter,
it,
based
it
on Peter Orsog or something.
No, it was Jonathan Gruber.
That's right. Oh
who
man,
Gruber, a graphic novel.
Sorry,
not a,
not
comic,
a comic book.
A graphic novel
40
about
lashes
how the
with
Affordable
a wet
Care Act
for me.
Works, which I believe I reviewed for Reason Magazine.
Yes, you did.
A
that
number
is
of years
certainly
ago.
How I know about it. All right, Johnny Healthcare, take it away.
So basically, the new rule requires a separation between. It's sort of a bright line rule requiring physical and financial separation between clinics. That receive federal funding. Effectively, it says in order to get federal money to do reproductive, to do certain types of healthcare services, you have to have a clear separation between your operations. If you're going to do abortion, it's got to be totally a different thing. Versus counseling and sort of other types of similar services. In addition, there's also a restriction in terms of what sorts of things you can tell people who come in to counseling, which is somewhat interesting. given that that it was issued the same week, this sort of gag rule, basically barring clinics from talking about abortion as part of this proposal, at the same week, the Center for Medicaid and Medicare Services, the big healthcare agency in the federal government, also issued a rule requiring attempting to stop pharmaceutical companies from gagging pharmacists from just talking about drug prices. So on the one hand, they're saying there's no gag rule that is allowed here to talk about drug prices. That's not going to be allowed. And on the other hand, they're saying clinics, you're not allowed to talk about abortion when people come in here. But basically, it's an issue of separation. And the folks on the pro-abortion side will say, you know, well, look, the money's already separated. And the folks who are on the pro-life side, excuse me, to the pro-choice side, the pro-life side, will say, well, look, money is fungible. And, you know, I think, you know, my kind of basic opinion on all of this is just that when you federally fund health services in a country where abortion is legal, you're inevitably going to run into these conflicts. And there is just no way to avoid these sort of moral and social conflicts and people being very upset on at least one side, if not both, as long as both of those things are true.
So, Nick, just to invoke the Federalist here, what's, you know, this sounds like a libertarian no-brainer. You know, it's a point of conscience. I don't want to fund abortion. So this is, you know, this is less government spending. This sounds great. What's wrong with you?
Yeah. Well, one, it's not less government spending because the spending is going to continue. So it doesn't affect the bottom line of how much the government spends. And
it's possible it might reduce the amount of government spending and, if basically Planned Parenthood stops doing a bunch of stuff and then the funding sort of that funding
stream dries up. Talking about $260 million, which will go somewhere else. But personally,
it's not
I agree with Peter in the sense, you know, like abortion is legal. It is becoming more rare. So it's, you know, it's legal, it's safe, and it's rarer than it was when Bill Clinton and Hillary Clinton used to talk about, you know, what abortion was. I find this kind of stuff, the fundamental trespass that's going on here is between doctors and patients and people seeking aid. And it's like, I am struggling even to talk about this. When I came into the libertarian movement, by which I mean when I was hired by Reason in late 1993, everybody I knew who was a libertarian, even if they were personally opposed to abortion, basically was in favor of freedom of choice, that the government should not be dictating things. We have a policy, Matt, as you talked about, which is widely popular, which says, you know, based on Roe versus Wade, and it's, you know, and it's been limited in various ways and elaborated in others and stuff like that. But with, you know, where we talk about trimesters and abortion on demand is basically fully legal without exception through the first trimester. And then as you get closer to birth and to personhood, which is a legal category, not a biological one, it's harder and harder to get an abortion. It seems to me that's exactly right. When you look at the actual ways that people think about abortion, it has not changed fundamentally since the early 70s. Abortion was being legalized because people recognized that women have a right to control their body, particularly when we're talking about a fetus or something even smaller than a fetus. It just drives me nuts that conservatives who are constantly bitching and moaning about government overreach and all of that in this thing, they're like going off the charts and saying, no, you know, the government should micromanage every aspect of anything that has to do with abortion. The successful way to reduce abortion is to have better family planning and to have more open discussions about sexuality. This gets in the way of that. And ironically, it might end up leading to more abortion. So suck it, conservatives. Argue, lobby and push for better behavior on the part of people, which can and is happening, and is reducing the number of unwanted pregnancies, which is the proper goal. And don't even get me started on, you know, Catholics who are not only against abortion but are against birth control.
Because
if they're gonna be consistent, You know, they should be, you know, they should be demonstrating in front of any federally funded or any government funded thing that gives out contraception, not just performs abortion.
All right. So, Catherine, yeah, I got to hop in here real quick. So, like, this, there's a couple of parts of this argument here that are ridiculous that you're making, Nick. Like, first of all, the idea, okay, it doesn't cut spending very much, so why bother? Like, we bother about things that don't cut spending very much all the time. Any spending we can cut is good. I don't think this is primarily a spending question, but So I don't think it's primarily a spending question, but I do think waving away the spending element of it is unfair. We care about spending on turtle crossings, right?
We're for it.
The broader question, though, of...
Let's save those turtle babies.
Like, of course this is dumb culture war shit. Of course that's what this fight is about. And in fact, at this point, there's an incredibly poisonous dynamic where even if it would actually be in the interest of Planned Parenthood to simply become a private nonprofit entity, fundraise on their own, and provide services on their own, these political battles are so good for them now that they are going to keep fighting them no matter what, right? So there's an additional layer here, which is that it's now like a self-reinforcing culture war dumpster fire. At the same time, I think it is very, very clear that you can be a robust holder of the most extensive form of the pro-choice position and still say the federal government funding Planned Parenthood is bad and it should be ended. And I think that that is broadly
In what way? In what way? Because they don't use federally funded money for abortion. So you're just saying that there should be no private nonprofits or, non-governmental agencies.
I think it is
dispense any kind of contraception.
Yeah, I think it is perfectly reasonable to say the vast majority of healthcare services are non-controversial from a moral or ideological or political perspective. There are a few things that are controversial. Those things should be provided external to the rest of our healthcare system.
Okay.
Now,
so
I don't
that's
think...
that's happening, right? That's happening because
they don't
use federal money.
It's not happening
because
if you've ever looked at a Planned Parenthood fundraising campaign or the way that they package themselves, the way that they do their rhetoric, it's...
Okay, so you're saying any agency that or any group that actually performs abortions under any one of its various, subdivisions should not get any federal money for anything ever.
I think
they also lose their, because it's controversial, should they lose their taxpayer status, tax exempt status?
I think the bullshit
here is on the side of anti-abortion.
No, I think that points to the underlying problems with federally funding all types of services, and I think we all agree about that. But even in a world where those services are federally funded, I think that it is a legitimate thing to say you can create systems where these few extremely controversial healthcare services are provided outside of our normal healthcare stream. I think that
is any doctor who accepts Medicaid or Medicare should never be able to talk about abortion with their patients because that's what this is about.
So what I was actually going to say, though,
is
that I think the speech question here is different. And I think both sides of this debate behave horribly when it comes to speech and information, right? There is a difference between saying you can provide information, you can provide referrals, you can provide insight, you can provide connections. All of those things are separate. And, you know, of course, the pro-life forces are constantly trying to compel women to get sonograms or to have waiting periods or to have, certain type of counseling before they have abortion. Just in the same way that there is a strong desire to stop people from hearing the other side on both parts. And I think that that is... I think that that is wrong. I think that that is ridiculous. But I still think that it is a legitimate point to say we have a highly politicized question. We have people who disagree on a deep, fundamental moral level. And it's reasonable to try and come up with accommodations, even within our system that has way too much federal funding in healthcare, to move those elements outside of the mainstream.
I would commend everyone listening to this, including the people who are busy yelling at each other right now on this podcast, to reread Elizabeth Nolan Brown's great op-ed for the LA Times in 2017 that talked about what Planned Parenthood actually does. And something like half of its operations or half of its caseload are Medicaid patients. So they're people who they tend to be poor. They tend to, their clinics are... I think more than half of them are in places that are officially designated as underserved. And the Congressional Budget Office, when looking at what would happen under at least one kind of defunding scenario, came up with the conclusion that there would probably be a net increase in the amount of federal government spending, in part because there'd be less contraceptive services out there.
I just think that's a very static way of thinking. I think Liz makes great points in that piece. It was a very good piece. But I also think the reason that all of those institutions have evolved the way they have is because the funding structure has been in place the way it has. And I don't think it's unreasonable to say, first of all, there are a lot of people who are invested in providing contraceptive and healthcare services to women, especially to poor women. This is not a difficult cause to fundraise against. It's also not difficult to imagine if it was necessary and if it was, in fact, enshrined in law and then predictably enforced, that there would just be different types of clinics that would evolve and be set up both in the nonprofit realm and in the public realm. The fact that right now the way it is entrenched is because it's a winning political issue for both sides, because it's always going to go back and forth, because it's always going to be a live battle. It's in everyone's interests to stick in and say, if we don't have the money that we've always had exactly the way it is, everyone will suddenly be bleeding in the streets. And that's simply not true.
I think there is a little bit of a two-step here on the part of Planned Parenthood, which basically says, well, you know, providing abortion services is a very small part of what we do. And also, if you require us to separate that business out so that
our business cannot function and we will have to close all the clinics.
Yeah,
it's the same thing that we always oppose when we talk about budget cuts and teachers, right? Reason has written this article a million times. It cannot simultaneously be true that teachers are a small and worthy part of the budget and that any budget cut immediately requires us to fire every single public school teacher. This
type of rhetoric misses the point about how government
How government funding cuts can dynamically influence industries.
We get upset every time that the federal government tries to condition speech based on the money that it gets or behavior.
Yeah.
And, you
Which,
know,
again,
and
is
that's
why
what's happening here.
Having our druthers, yeah, but, we would move the federal government out of all of this. But given the status quo, I still think that it is a bigger problem to require Stephanie Slade to pay for my abortion than it is to worry about.
How is she paying for your abortion?
This is the exact thing that Peter just said. Like, Planned Parenthood simultaneously says all the money is totally separate, and if that money for abortion goes away, we will have to shut down all of our operations.
So,
like, money is fungible.
Stephanie,
Nick, we all work for a nonprofit, and we're familiar with nonprofit budgeting. And let's talk about nonprofits generally. Just like any organization, money is fungible, right? Like, you have maybe a set of dollars for a program.
But if Amazon is spending money to create original videos,
that money is part of, in some sense, the same amount of money that they're spending to create their grocery delivery
program.
Apply
that consistently, then, because I don't want my money in the form of tax-exempt status, which is ultimately what we're talking about in this situation, going to the Catholic Church, in which I have received at least four sacraments, including extreme unction, taking last rites to the extreme.
How much do you think you paid for each sacrament?
I feel like, let's hear that story.
I don't want them to be spreading, healthcare that doesn't include the use of contraception, which is legal and is unobjectionable, even to the, I will point out, even to the Vatican Commission that Pope Paul VI in the late 60s commissioned to look into whether or not contraception was compatible with the Catholic faith. They said yes. He overruled them.
The Catholic Church used to provide a lot of social services, and when they decided that they didn't like the terms the federal government was imposing on them, they stopped providing those services. That's an option available to anyone.
They still get tons of money for Catholic hospitals, and they get tax-exempt status, which is a moral imprimatur in this argument, because Planned Parenthood is not using the money that they get from the government for abortions. And if you want to say everything is fungible, then that means the only answer to everything is stop all government spending right now.
Done.
Except we all agree.
Yeah.
But that's a bad conversation. That's like going back to the Second Amendment thing. Like, oh, you know what? The only argument that matters is I've got my guns and I've got the Constitution on my side. Fuck you. I think we need to have a cultural battle a cultural conversation about abortion within the libertarian movement, which we did. And Catherine and I, people may not realize this, but we, I think, are in exactly the same position in terms of policy on abortion. Catherine, Ron Bailey, myself, and Molly Hemingway of the Federalist, you can look it up. We had a libertarian
Molly Hemingway,
conversation,
not in exactly about. The same position, to be clear.
No, yeah. She is not. She is not, and neither is Ron, actually. But having said all of that, I think we need to recognize as libertarians, you know, A, that the government is not going away anytime soon, and then what are the limits that you condition acceptance of the government with the ability to act and speak freely? And I think this is problematic for me. I don't care about Planned Parenthood, you know, per se. I care about the ability of people who get government funding, whether it's at, you know, via state schools or research into other science and medical and other kinds of issues. Like, I think that it should be, I mean, I believe that that food stamps should be given to people as cash, unrestricted cash benefits. You know, I think the same should be true. If we're funding something, just give it to people as long as they're not committing crimes.
Speaking of crimes, Tom Wolfe died last week. Does that work?
Nope.
Why not?
He was a fashion criminal.
Wolf. Wrong.
Thank
Wrong.
You. That's a nice Nick.
Spats are quiet. Never a bad
no,
choice.
No, I like his suits a lot.
Unless you're
Tom Wolfe fulfilled Nick Gillespie's charge to me once when he finally hired me at Reason, which is that we don't have uniforms here. All we or, you know, dress codes here. All we ask is that you show some kind of internal logic that makes sense to you and to everyone
is
else.
Is that
out
real?
There.
Was that did that conversation really happen?
Yep, sure yep. did. He doesn't yep. remember it because he was yeah. high as a kite. But
I remember what you yes. told me when you hired me, Matt,
don't
what
understand.
The dress code was.
What did Matt tell you
yeah,
the dress code was?
Yeah, stop wearing that douchebag hat was my advice.
No, if he wants to wear a hat, just wear the hat like you mean it, goddammit.
Wear the hat like you mean it may have been the Nick Gillespie dress code, but the Matt Welch dress yeah. code was dress like you want to appear if somebody shows up in the office who you would care about seeing you, which is actually really good advice
good.
For how
yeah.
to dress
yeah.
in any office that doesn't have a pre-existing dress code.
It's a little other-directed, though, for a libertarian organization.
Yeah, but that's what you fashion what, is about. I mean, we call it personal style, but it's really for other people.
Not for Nick.
Yeah,
Catherine,
no,
what's
I was
going
to say, that explains a lot to me, Peter. Thank you. And where my major failure has occurred.
My hat was for you, Nick.
My dress code is.
I like that.
My dress code
like
is the only true libertarian dress code, which is just wear whatever you want to wear. I don't give a fuck.
Yeah, it's, man.
Nick, I thought we decided that we'd no anarchists. It just didn't work out.
Y'all didn't
that way.
Decide that. I hate to break it to you.
Either that or was no, a failed it, decision.
Yeah, you might have decided it. I guess we'll say that, but your implementation yeah. is lacking. Let's talk about Tom Wolfe.
Let's talk about Tom Wolfe. Nick, I want you to go first because no. Catherine's story is going to be better than yours.
Yeah, I don't have a story. I just
don't have a story. But
I have a lapidary insight, which you could use.
But
to
in addition
cut
to the sacraments
LSD
of tab. Unction, you have the sacrament of like a doctorate in literature or some bullshit like that. So yeah. can you place Tom Wolfe in the American letters context?
Yeah, I mean, I wrote about him when he died, and I pointedly said, Matt, that I'll leave that to other people because I the one thing I will say about
him. I'm
giving
him, you an assignment, pal.
Okay. No, is that everybody is like, my God, he wrote great sentences, you know, or he revived the exclamation point, you know, and it's like his prose style is absolutely, I think, fundamentally the least interesting thing about him. What he was, first and foremost, was a great reporter and a great researcher. And I believe it was the essay published in Harper's before the revised version of Bonfire of the Vanities came out. As a novel, it had been written serially and poorly, even by his own estimation, in Rolling Stone for about a year and a half or 2 years before it ended up coming out as a book in the late 80s and perfectly captured something about what was happening in New York and America. But I think what was great about him is that he was a reporter. He also had a doctorate, I believe, in American Studies from Yale, and he took training both as a kind of ethnographer as well as a historian or somebody who thought about the long train of where do ideas come from and where do they end up. Really seriously, and like, you know, the electric Kool-Aid acid test, which along with The Right Stuff is probably his best known works of nonfiction, like he spent a hell of a lot of time with the people that he was writing about. And I think that's really important. And the other thing is the specific insight that runs through most of his work, but was most specifically articulated in the 1976 cover story for New York Magazine called The Me Decade, or The Third Great Awakening, where he said what had happened in post-war America was that everybody got more money and more freedom to live however they wanted, and that this was a freedom that was only given to aristocrats in the past, and that it was a bold revolution in American society. And it defines not just the 70s, which he coined the term the Me Decade for, but everything from post-war on. And I think we're still living in that world. It's incredibly liberating. There are negative effects of that. But by and large, that's the world we're living in. And I think that's the real key to what you and I wrote about in the Declaration of Independence and before is the libertarian moment. No, but it is like we take for granted this radical freedom to dress. You know, it's a good conversation to start with talking about dress codes, to dress how we want, to work from wherever we want, to love, to eat, to build whatever we want. And that, you know, Tom Wolfe's The Me Decade is the essay that explains that and the where it came from and the ramifications of it. And I think it anybody who reads it will understand contemporary America in the 21st century better.
Catherine, you put on the Twitter machine some just awful photographic evidence of some kind of Civil War reenactment that you did with Tom Wolfe. Tell us the story.
That is not what happened. Okay, so there's the story. First of all, I want to associate myself with Nick's remarks on Tom Wolfe, though not on Planned Parenthood, since I think everything he said there is totally right. However, I am now going to tell you a story that has nothing to do with anything but is just weird as shit. When I was an undergraduate at Yale University, I don't know if you've heard of it or not.
Thanks, that's helpful.
I, due to a variety of bad life choices, wound up participating in Yale's 300th birthday celebration. And this involved many days of events culminating in a Twilight show that had a lot of celebrities and also an all singing, all dancing, all marching number honoring all of Yale's war dead. So they needed some people to play the part of Yale's war dead.
And why so is that funny?
Naturally, they asked the marching band. And so in the
wait, you were still in the marching band in college?
Yeah, don't hate. It was fun. So anyway, what ended up here was that 19-year-old Catherine.
Here's a group of 300 people who
wear
uniforms.
Can walk in a row, I think was the answer. And so what ends up is 19-year-old Catherine is given a World War I soldier's uniform, including that kind of like tin bucket hat. I don't know what those are called, the helmets. and I'm put into this uniform along with, 100 of my closest friends. And we're supposed to go do a thing as part of the birthday show, but I'm somehow late. I forget why, but probably alcohol was involved. I'm late. And so I hop on the back of a golf cart, which is headed for the Yale Bowl. Imagine, if you will, it's the Connecticut twilight, the gloaming even. And I look and
the gloaming.
The person in the golf cart with me is Tom Wolfe in his white suit, just looking dapper as hell. It's me dressed as a World War I soldier and Tom Wolfe in a golf cart as our golf cart speeds toward our destination.
And that is what we call an inciting incident.
Bill Buckley and Big Bird walk by.
What?
Together because they're also Yale alumni.
And what was Big Bird wear? What war was he costumed?
Big Bird was not, unfortunately, in uniform.
Big Bird's major at Yale?
I don't know, but Bill Buckley and Big Bird then did a sketch on the stage where they talked about words that start with the letter Y. I'm not kidding. No. And this is a true story. The coda of this story is that about 15 years later, somebody contacted me on Facebook and said, "Hi, I have your college ID because I just bought a large lot of surplus military uniforms in Jacksonville, Florida, and I found your college ID in the pocket of a World War I uniform. Do you want it back? Because the internet is great. So there you go. That's my Tom Wolfe story.
And did you get it back?
You have to answer the questions. Did you get it back?
I didn't get it back. I had them send me photos, which you can see on my Twitter. And lo and behold, it is my World War I soldier jacket with my name taped inside the collar and my ID in the pocket.
That's a perfectly good time to segue into what cultural artifacts are you consuming out there. Suderman, since we haven't let you talk for a while, why don't you go first?
So I saw Deadpool 2. It's the second one. It's pretty good.
It's very helpful.
I think it's pretty good. It's definitely not bad. It works really, really hard. Like, it's just, like, you know the kid in the class who may not be, like, quite the most brilliant, but really is just, like, does all of his homework on time, really checks all the boxes, like, checks in with the teacher constantly. Just, like, that's how hard it works to be entertaining at every single second, every frame of this film. And so I kind of respect, like, a movie that takes its job to be entertaining. Seriously, two other things that I would sort of note about it. One is, in a way, it is the most complex of the superhero films that I have seen in 2018. And yes, I am obviously comparing it to Infinity War, which is the 19th movie in a 10-year mega franchise made up of sub-franchises. But Deadpool 2 is so dense and rife with superhero movie reference, going back not just to sort of recent films, but sort of all through the last kind of 20 years of Hollywood movies, that in some ways I think you could make a case anyway that it asks more of the viewers and asks them to kind of recall and synthesize and turn over in their head superhero movie history even more than Infinity War does. And the final thing that I'd say about it that struck me as interesting is that it is a kind of unique or at least an interesting experiment in doing very bro-y, very R-rated, very raunchy comedy within the contexts of, and I use this word descriptively, not pejoratively, wokeness. It is a movie that, like, goes out of its way to sort of fit into the sort of woke paradigm and, like, makes sort of, there's humor about how one of the characters is, sort of a recurring joke about how one of the characters is maybe a racist and things like that. And, you know, it's sort of interesting to see
is
that
joking
happen.
Joking about being a racist part of the wokeness paradigm?
It's in this context, it totally is. It's like, oh, this is problematic, this is right, I've talked to some other folks about this, and there's kind of an argument. Well, on the one hand, is it trying to make fun of wokeness, or is it trying to joke within the confines, the boundaries that wokeness establishes? It's a little bit trying to have it both ways, but in trying to have it both ways, it's trying to do so without ever overstep those bounds. And given the kind of history of raunchy R-rated comedies being not totally, but largely kind of boys clubs, it's really kind of built around, like, dick jokes, right? Like, that's kind of the fundamental unit of an R-rated raunchy comedy. It's a little bit interesting to see an experiment that I think is at least reasonably successful in moving that into a kind of a different social realm and set of social expectations. Anyway, it's an interesting movie, and it's also pretty funny, and there are dick jokes.
Nick, what kind of cultural experimentation have you been engaging in?
Are you painting them?
Over the weekend, I painted the front of
along
my
with
house
your whole
in
block.
Ohio, and I'm going to be coming around to painting the sides and the back. I hope eventually. Oh, that would be nice. I would love to. Now, I painting a blazing white, and I got the cheapest paint possible because that's what I'm worth, and that's certainly what my house is worth. But Matt, I did find time while I was cooling my heels after painting my house. No thanks to my sons, by the way, who were inside along with a cat watching me and asking me questions about when we were going to eat. While I was doing it, during a rainstorm, I might add, but Tom Wolfe is
dead. Uphill both ways in the snow.
No. So I watched Fahrenheit 451 on HBO yesterday. And what a piece of junk. Although I don't blame any of the actors or even the director or the storyteller. I mean, I think fundamentally, Ray Bradbury's novel is, which came out in 1953 and is still celebrated as an incredibly prescient, you know, kind of take on a post-literary America, et cetera. Fahrenheit 451, like 1984, like Brave New World, like most dystopias, it seems to me like we're always fighting the last dystopia. And, it, you know, like, is there anything? I mean, I just can't stand these, you know, dystopias from the kind of high point or the end point of modernism, both as a literary phenomenon, but also as a kind of conceptual framework where a few people were going to control all the information. And then, you know, and we were either going to be, you know, made in a petri dish to be alphas and betas and zetas and all of that, or, you know, merely by having a telescreen in the in every room, we would never be able to have freedom or privacy. It turns out the future is a lot more complicated. And the one thing that we don't have to worry about is the loss of literary culture or books or knowledge or information. We've got that, you know, coming out of our
I give that a thumbs up emoji.
But it never seems like dystopias never catch.
Peter is on the verge
it's a tired paradigm.
Words. Like, I would say 70% of the communications I receive from Peter at this point are emojis, and we often have complex conversations about running Reason.com. So there's your counterexample.
Thinking face.
And he could be more concise.
Upside down, crying
even with
face.
The emojis.
That's
so
also
we're
laughing.
Working on it. But let's make a utopia. Let's stop reading, you know, a 50, 60, 70-year-old utopia and pretending it's a roadmap to now. One of the great books on this was Peter Huber, the analyst at the Manhattan Institute. I don't know, like 20 years ago, wrote a book called Orwell's Revenge, the 1984 Palimpsest. And it was a great kind of way about a great look at how Orwell got things wrong at the dawn of the World Wide Web. And that's prescient. You know, the past, like the future, is never what you expect it to be. And luckily, I think our future is.
I do think of my face as just an extremely sophisticated emoji generator.
What does the hat mean when you're wearing the hat?
He doesn't wear it anymore.
What emotion is that guy?
That got removed from the latest emoji collection update.
The Unicode Consortium agreed that fedoras were out.
What about the purple stream of tears, Peter?
I think Catherine is the expert on all things purple.
And also tears.
Ah.
Catherine, what dystopias are making you cry?
So I, last night, went for a walk down by the beautiful Washington, D.C. monuments. And so the thing that I want to talk about for what I'm consuming this week is the George Mason Memorial, which is the saddest memorial. Yeah. It's between the Jefferson Memorial and the Roosevelt Memorial.
Wait, there really is one?
Yes, there is one. It's just a large bench with a stagnant pool in front of it. And there's a sign.
And is it like it's a reconfigured chess piece from
there's
like a
sign
Franklin Mint
out front that just
founding
says
father's
the forgotten
chess piece
founder?
Or something.
And then there's another sign that's fallen down on the ground that says that this monument is under renovation and closed to the public. The whole thing is surrounded by that orange fencing that you sometimes see at construction sites. And obviously I went over to have a selfie taken on George Mason's lap. He's a larger than life-size seated figure in this monument, at which point a pedicab containing two elderly, tourists came up. And I heard them saying as they came up that they were pretty sure this was a Civil War general. So the whole thing was really sad is what I'm saying. George Mason, great underrated anti-federalist and bomb founder, tragically committed to the ash heap of America's monument collection.
He's considered the father of the Bill of Rights,
He's probably the father of all the things. Who even knows? But yes. And as a child, I was frequently dragged. My parents were always taking me to historic houses because my dad was an architect. Gunston Hall was like my nemesis. I was always at fucking Gunston Hall. Like, I could tell you a lot about the architectural features of Gunston Hall, which was George Mason's home. So
I'm looking forward to a listicle, rank ordered monuments by sadness level.
Oh, God.
I'm assuming, wow. Have you, Catherine, as a Virginia native, Alexandrian, right, by birth,
yes.
If not by choice?
Yeah.
But how sad is Montpelier, James Monroe's house, which is near James Madison's and Mr. Jefferson's?
Well, I mean, yeah, Monticello's going to take it any day. And then after that, yeah, things start to really go downhill. But yeah, I urge everyone to look up the George Mason Memorial and to go see it if you're in Washington, D.C., and maybe leave a wreath of flowers.
I once went to James Buchanan's home, which is called like Willow Wheat or Wheatgrass or something, in the middle of nowhere. I'm thinking it's in Pennsylvania. I'm not even sure.
Wheatgrass would be a great
name. So at least it gets like stray macrobiotic people who are really hungry and are like, oh, I thought this was a vegan joint. Matt, were you with me when did you see the Gerald Ford presidential exhibit in Grand Rapids, Michigan, which is like smaller than an old Walden Books would be in a mall. I mean, it was like basically it was a place to, get out of the cold, which is often in Grand Rapids. But
I love without any sense of irony, all presidential libraries because they're these elaborate works of fiction and craziness. And my favorite recent example was a couple of years ago. I went up the Hudson Valley to the FDR Museum, and there is this tiny, tiny, sad little corner with like 12-point, Times New Roman thin or something. You have to get a magnifying glass to read it. That said, yeah, and there were a couple of people who criticized the New Deal, but they were mostly like
when
Nazis.
I was in Little Rock visiting our printer, the cab driver went out of his way to point out to me that the Clinton Library looks exactly like a double-wide trailer.
Oh, wow, with James Carville dragging a 20. I should say that my cultural thing is that I last week finished the latest and last book by John McCain with his co-author Mark Salter called The Restless Wave, which is kind of the last of his three-ish memoirs. It's an interesting read. I would commend especially the chapter he writes that's very convincing about torture and our torture programs and how awful they were and how awful the Tom Cotton-style apologia for them have been. Book also is notable for him kind of admitting on the side, the Iraq War has to be seen as a mistake, which is, and the people like me who advocated for it need to take some responsibility for that. Needless to say, this is a new tune that he is singing, very different than what he was saying in, the 2004 Republican convention, where he was saying that only the most deluded would think anything but that it was the right thing to do.
Hey, Matt,
anyways,
do you agree with, I saw a bunch of headlines based on, I guess, the early reads of that book, that he was the most consequential Republican, party official post-Reagan. Does that hold up, or in what ways is that true, and is that a good thing or a bad thing?
I posited this on Twitter and had some pretty interesting feedback. My first initial claim that I wrote somewhere, I think in the LA Times, was that he is the most consequential non-president in Washington, like in an elected official position since the end of the Cold War. Based that largely on the way that he was able to influence people and not just Republicans on the question of interventionism and specific interventions, Kosovo and Iraq and other ones. People pointed out that maybe Dick Cheney is ultimately more influential. And I think practically speaking, that's probably true. And also, you know, Dick Cheney was part of the first Gulf War as well. But he's in there. John McCain's not more consequential than George W. Bush. That just doesn't make any sense. But he is up there. He especially in his ability to persuade people across the aisle, people in the media, his base, as he once called them, of things that aren't so. He kind of, refracted that do something mentality that I think is the default of many, you know, newspaper editorial boards and whatnot. Anyways, we're running kind of late. So just quick, Nick, do you have any podcasts you want to tell the kids about coming up?
Oh, yeah. Lots of podcasts. Lots of great podcasts, Matt. Including Thanks, one with helpful. You. Including one with you about John McCain.
Event stuff, as mentioned last week, Reason's going to be at the Foundation for Economic Education's annual summer conference, FeeCon, in June. Go to Hit and Run for details. You can have discounts there as well. And again, thanks for listening. Reminder to subscribe to us over there on YouTunes. We like those YouTunes.
Ooh, wow. Plays.
On YouTunes.
Also on the friend
subscribe,
book.
Rate.
You should follow us yeah. on...
Get us on the tubes.
Friends
Insta snaps.
Right. Right. Write a review for
I love
about
that
us
you know
there.
That Matt is talking into an old style telephone with the earpiece that's separate from the
Okay.
That's correct.
Just like
okay.
Battlestar Galactica.
Thanks for listening.
Goodbye, everyone.
What?
Goodbye.